We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast brought to you by friends over at WinBet.
Your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. We got a ton to get to on today's show. We are going to get into the latest with those Julio Jones rumors. So see how that impacts that whole Atlanta Falcons offense, and who better to talk to about that than you, Mario. And then we're also going to get into the recent RotoWire NFL PPR mock that we did for the magazine last week. I was picking out of the 13th spot, so we'll break down my team, the strategy, and then we're just going to kind of use that as a jumping off point to talk about early round running back strategy. You know, not necessarily zero RB or modified zero RB, but just kind of like separating into tiers a little bit, seeing you know, the guys that we're targeting at various stages depending on where you pull your specific draft position. But Mario, fill us in. What is going on with Julio Jones? It looks like a report from Jeff Schultz down there in Atlanta this morning indicated that the Falcons are looking to move Julio Jones. This was something that, you know, was kind of discussed pre-draft, but then it kind of went away these last few weeks, and now it seems like the volume is turned up on this particular storyline.
Yeah, so I don't actually know who Schultz is. That they very well could be well plugged in and have a good history of reports. I don't know either way. I assume they're, you know, pretty much somewhat plugged in at the very least. It doesn't seem like it's plausible enough of a report to have come out, especially given the Falcons cap situation. But it is a little bit confusing to me, or at least from how I would think makes sense building their team personnel wise. It makes very little sense to me to move Julio at this point after taking Kyle Pitts fourth overall. And I know that some people might be saying like, well, Pitts can replace him and it works out that way. And they can just kind of run the Tennessee offense where it's like AJ Brown and Corey Davis just doing like downfield in breaking routes off the play action, and it's all going to work out. But I don't really think it will if they do that, because, or unless they make a big move at running back, because Mike Davis is a backup caliber talent. Like he's good.
Did
enough,
you see maybe. His legs? Did you see his legs this week?
Yeah. That one was weird because he's always been a really well-built guy. He's like 5'8" and a half and like 215, 220 or something. He was always really well-built even when he was at South Carolina. Yeah. He's just like, you know, he's functionally decent, but he's not a top 32 running back in the NFL. So if you want to base a scheme off of what you did in Tennessee with a 2-3 tight end offense with two receivers, usually that makes sense when you have Derrick Henry, but when you have Mike Davis, you probably need a Julio Jones around to pick up the resulting slack. So anyway, going with Pitts at the fourth spot, to me, would have only made sense if they were trying to compete right now. And trading Julio means you're not trying to compete right now. They might try to justify it with like, oh, well, we're so up against the cap, we got to do it. And let's just say that's the case. Then it still doesn't make sense to take Pitts at four because you needed to take Justin Fields there, because now you're not going to be bad enough, unless Matt Ryan gets hurt, you're not going to be bad enough this year to get a high enough pick to be within range of any quarterback who might be worth drafting high next year to solve this problem that you chose not to solve with the fourth pick when you actually were there in the first place and you didn't have to trade up to get there. So I think it would have made a lot of sense to go with Kyle Pitts, and that article that I wrote last week is pretty much already obsolete, or if they trade Julio, it will be obsolete, because I thought the math worked out pretty well. If you go with a pass heavy offense, going with all of Julio, Calvin Ridley, Kyle Pitts, and then I think with those guys, yeah, the running back doesn't even really matter. It can be Mike Davis, it can be somebody else, who cares, it doesn't really matter. It will matter if you don't have Julio out there and you have just, you know, a rookie tight end receiver and then Calvin Ridley, who is not the most durable guy either. So I see a lot of ways that this can go a little bit wrong, and it's hard to tell how much say Arthur Smith had in all of this, and whether some of it might have been like ownership or just somebody in the front office that he didn't necessarily agree with fully. It's tough to tell what they think they're doing exactly and how many people have gotten their hands over it and, you know, got their fingerprints on this thing they're mushing together. But I think if they trade Julio, it'll be certainly like a bitter thing at the very least, because yeah, they're up against the cap, but you shouldn't use bad decisions on past contracts to justify like getting rid of one of your good decisions.
Right. And also, didn't they bring in Terry Fontenot from New Orleans, who's like known for playing, you know, like right up to the edge of the salary cap and like kind of just having wizardy ways with, you know, figuring out cap stuff. So, I mean, I feel like that there are better ways, like he's shown better ways to box his way out of the corner in New Orleans, to where it's like, can't you find something better to do than just getting rid of Julio Jones?
Yeah, and the other thing is they kind of put themselves in this situation by, granted, they would have been up against the cap either way, but they gave a $10 million fully guaranteed salary to Dante Fowler, who sucks and would be easily replaced with just like anybody. It's like you're not gonna go from a crap defense to a good one because you paid up for Dante Fowler. That's just like you're bad and you're bad with or without him. So just accept that you suck and put your money towards something that can actually be productive, like maybe keeping the best, I don't know, player in Falcons history on your team when he was still very productive last year. So the other thing is, it's like, because they are only trading him to remove his salary, they necessarily won't get a very good offer for it. Like it only really makes sense to trade a player like Julio Jones when you're going into a rebuild. And it makes sense to trade him ideally when he has some actual value on the market. But if they're basically paying teams to take his salary instead of take his talent, they're going to say like, oh, well, we're not going to give you that much. We're going to give you like a fourth rounder in 2022. And, you know, we'll eat like 5 million of it. It's like, what is keeping Dante Fowler on the roster and getting a fourth rounder worth to a team that's looking at this, you know, set of circumstances that it has? Like it's just stuff you do when you're not thinking it through, when you're not thinking about what you're actually doing with any of this, whether like you got to have some sort of plan, I guess, in the sense that you just need to think about what happens after you do something. And it doesn't seem to me like they're doing that, or maybe they're just thinking things that I don't agree with. And maybe they're right and I'm wrong, but I definitely am thinking probably not. I don't know.
Oh, well, our buddy Sarfaraz Alam in the comments section says exactly to your point there, Mario. So I think some listeners out there definitely agree with your point of view on the way the Falcons are doing this.
Someone gave us a negative review in a CastBox or something. I mean, I see it in CastBox because I use that on my Walmart phone to listen to podcasts. And some guy said last year, he gave us like a 1-star review and was like, I had to stop listening to this podcast because he was being too mean to Thomas Dimitroff. And I wonder if that guy's, are you listening now again? Did you come back after this report this morning, or are you psyched to see your best players leave your team and you still suck for it?
Oh man, the Dimitrov defender legion out there.
Total buffoon.
A wily bunch.
It just shows that, like, if you just dress up like you're some sort of like Apple guy or something, people will think you're smart, even if you're just walking into traffic and like, barely missing trains as you're wandering around. And like, man, that guy's got a nice suit and those glasses. Did you see those? They don't have any rims on them. It's so shiny.
The man's a visionary.
I just wanted to do a job for him for very little money.
Oh, goodness. Okay. All right. Let's move off of Atlanta. Let's move on over to the PPR mock draft. So this is an exercise that we do for the magazine every single year. Kind of helps set, you know, in recent years now with you know, online draft championships and best ball basically being open from the day after the Super Bowl onward, we have a bit of a better understanding of ADP at this stage than we did in years past. But still, this is a useful, helpful exercise that we do every single year for the magazine. 14 teams, really, really strong room. You know, other RotoWire guys like Jerry Donabedian, Scott Genstad, Logan Larson were all in there, and ton of other people from around the industry. The Athletic was represented, Fantasy Points, Football Diehards, Fade the Noise. I mean, just a who's who of guys in this room. So I want to kick things off just kind of breaking down my team and my initial strategy and how things went. So actually, well, 15th, but due to some delays, we had to switch up the draft order just a little bit. And we moved the first pick back to the 14th pick, and then that bumped me up to 13. So instead of picking on the wheel, which I had a kind of a concrete idea of what I wanted to do, I was moved off of that. So I then had to kind of deal with the guy who was on the wheel as a result of that. So what I ended up doing was I took Darren Waller at number 13 overall. I know that that might have a little bit of sticker shock, and that wasn't something where I was trying to just kind of shake up the room for the sake of the mock. It is just a more of a tacit statement. Like I'm just trying to say that this is a guy who plays tight end and is going to get 100 catches this year. And that is something that only two, maybe three people are capable of. And as good as George Kittle is, it's hard for him to stay healthy, it seems like. And that's a real concern, whereas Darren Waller doesn't seem to have that issue. I know that injuries can crop up at any time. But all of that being said, Waller is such a huge staple of that offense that they lost Nelson Aguilar this free agency. So I don't see the target. I mean, the targets and the routes are different things when it comes to those two guys. But point remains, there's no way in my mind that Waller playing in 17 games is going to catch less than 100 passes. And I thought that was too valuable to pass up. The real question is, in terms of my game theory, though, could I have gotten him at pick number 16? Could I have gone ahead and taken DeAndre Swift at 13, waited for the next two picks, and then gotten Waller on the other side of that? I think in hindsight, that could have happened. And unfortunately, Swift was taken with one of those next two selections. So I kind of burned myself in that regard, but I bounced back by getting Austin Eckler. I felt okay about that as well. So what did you think of that strategy there? End of the first round in a 14 teamer thinking about Darren Waller.
Yeah, I guess it's a bummer that you didn't get Swift, but to me, Eckler and Swift are the same player. Maybe I have Swift a little higher, Eckler a little higher, actually. So I think it's fine. To me, with PPR scoring, Eckler and Swift are just guys that you basically hope you get similar share percentages of, because we are just mortals. We can't tell how it's going to go. And in the meantime, they have a lot of the same strengths and weaknesses, and just incidental details are very similar in their cases. So I think it's fine. But Waller, I guess maybe you and me are a little higher on him than a lot of people. I guess it's safe to say, because I think it's a fine pick. I think that it's generally, it seems a little arbitrary to me to have Kittle ranked ahead of Waller at all. I think it's, in some cases, people are probably just giving style points. They're letting like style points and aesthetic details break into their projections, because I know that Darren Waller doesn't do just like pro wrestling stuff out there or whatever, but he is a total freak athlete in his own right. And Kittle's a monster. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
But for me, even if Kittle plays every game, I just don't see it as a given that he's going to outproduce Waller, who I think is as good as him. Like, I think it's they're a little bit different stylistically, obviously, but Waller, he's catching 100 passes in 16 games, in my opinion. So 17, it's, you know, health permitting, that's pretty much a lock to me, especially with Aguilar gone. Like, I like Bryan Edwards, but if Edwards is even like 85% as good this year as Aguilar was last year, then he's one of the biggest steals of this draft season.
Yes. So
people, and also both could be quite good, which is how I tend to see it, actually, because as much as John Gruden's a terrible head coach, he is a good offensive coordinator and like play designer and play caller. So Derek Carr's had 2 good years in a row. I think you can think what I do, which is that Carr's really not that good, but he's still going to be productive on this team. And if that's the case, Waller is necessarily the engine of that whole deal. So I think people are still hung up on like just believing that he's some sort of flash in the pan, that he has to regress because he's Gary Barnage. He's not Darren Waller. He's Gary Barnage. And it's like, no, Waller's peripherals are super, super solid. Like there's nothing that indicates regression in his game. And in a lot of ways, there's ways it could go better than it has, especially, you know, touchdown production.
Yeah, I think so too. So I mean, again, you know, if you look at his player page on rotowire.com, it's just, especially on the advanced metrics side of things, the guy is just green light city everywhere. If you look at the air yardage per game, target share that he has within that offense is unique. It's hard to find another tight end that's drawing over 25% of his team's targets. Waller has that, and he's got the run after the catch ability. He's got the high catch rate. And like you said, you know, looking, you know, at the physical tools, the physical traits, when it comes to Waller, he's rare. I mean, you're not supposed to see guys that big and tall be able to move as fast. Like the only real comparison that I could have bought when it came to people trying to figure out what Kyle Pitts looked like at this level, it was Darren Waller. Like that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So, I mean, take that for what you will, but yeah, I think that the idea that you have to have Kittle as your tight end too, it needs to be reevaluated. And I think that Waller is a totally legit candidate to be the tight end too. And, you know, when it's all said and done this year, it wouldn't shock me completely if he outscored Travis Kelce either. I don't know if that's a hot take or not.
Well, I thought that he had fewer than 9 touchdowns last year. I didn't realize he had 9. Waller did. So I guess he's probably not going to do better than touchdowns, contrary to what I just said. But I do notice that his yards per target was down to 8.2 last year with that really high usage. So to me, that seems like it could go up to me. Like maybe he just kind of breaks. Like he didn't have a 40-yard catch last year and he had 2 in 2019. So it seems that seems to me like the kind of thing where when it bounces again this third year here, he's going to get a 40-yarder or two and probably push for like 9 yards per target while still catching a really high percentage. So an interesting thing about Waller, not to dwell on it too much, is like he's one of these guys, I love to see this in pass catchers. His average depth of target was 70th percentile last year at 7.8 yards. But his air yardage per snap was at 89th percentile. Like it's a really encouraging thing to me, especially when you're at such a high volume as Waller was, to have an air yardage per snap percentile that's higher than your depth of target. Cause that basically means like there's tension between like the defense in you and they're not stopping you. Like you're getting more usage than the amount that you're moving. You know, would normally dictate relative to the average. So he's just, they know he's coming up for him every play and they just haven't even gotten the vague scent of slowing him down after 2 years.
Nope. So, and you know, he's still just 28. So, I mean, he's still right smack in the prime of his career. And you know, I think that we're in for another great season. And then just one more, add on to circle back to what you, mentioned just a minute ago, that this has more to do with best balls or deeper drafts. This one was just 13 rounds and you had to draft a kicker and a defense. But in best ball formats, Bryan Edwards is floating around there in like the 18th oh, yeah. and the 19th round. Get him, buy in bulk. I promise you, like that is, you know, someone's got to replace Aguilar. Again, we don't think that he can necessarily replace a 1-to-1. It probably not. But I think that, you know, Edwards is a really interesting player, really just kind of a polished guy. So I think where he's going and with the targets that need to be replaced in that offense, Edwards is a great late round get.
He's going to be in the breakout player article that I'm writing for the magazine right now.
Let's go. Okay. I love
it. Among the 12.
Among the 12. Okay. He made the cut. I love that. Let's move on. So my next crop of picks, I went with David Montgomery. You know, that was just a point in the draft. No one's ever particularly stoked that they have David Montgomery, but I feel better about it today than I would have a year ago for sure. I know that there's a lot of argument when it comes to David Montgomery that, you know, the majority of his production was down the stretch against bad teams, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I think that this Bears offense, especially if it's Justin Fields back there, I think it's going to be a lot more wide open. And I think that they're, you know, teams are going to have to focus on stopping the run. Not that Mitchell Trubisky was a statue back there, but I think that, you know, less loaded boxes and things that just kind of generally help a replacement level running back get above replacement level production. I think those things will be working in David Montgomery's favor this year. And, you know, I was definitely going to take him over, you know, someone like a Josh Jacobs or something like that, who I have way more like workload concerns. So I just wanted to lock in the volume more than anything. Again, not particularly excited about this get, but when you looked at who else was there, you know, Myles Gaskin, Mike Davis, I just felt like the security with Montgomery's role made a lot of sense. And then I went with Cooper Kupp, actually, as you know, what turned out to be my first receiver there in the fourth round, in the start of the fourth round. But I feel happy about that, and I know that you're in on that Rams offense.
Yeah, so you were at the end of the round, right? So you had to. Whenever you're at the ends of the rounds, you have to do a lot of thinking about how much is going to be at any given position the next time you're up. And running back's a big one to you know, go into that fourth, fifth round range insecure. So I think Montgomery's in this category of running back where I'm definitely not targeting him, but he falls into that range of like probable running back twos who you can imagine finishing in like the top 10 among running backs if other players have bad injury luck, and you know, this guy has a few lucky twists in his season, stuff that, you know, could totally happen in both cases, and there's just only so much we can know. And so with Montgomery having that, you know, three down ability and getting the workload that he does, you can skip asking yourself how good you think he is and just kind of, you know, acknowledge that you're not going to get usage like that at your next pick and strategize accordingly. So I think it makes sense for your roster construction to do it that way, even if you have, you know, the slight concerns that you might have. So I think that getting that workload there, and, you know, so you had a Eckler, Montgomery, and Waller, and then you got Kupp in the, so that's yeah, I guess ideally you would do a little better than Kupp at wide receiver one, if only because he's been getting these knee troubles the past couple of years. And that's my main concern with him. He's clearly a good player. And if Stafford's on the field, I think they're, you know, they're basically locks, almost automatic. But if you have the good injury luck, and if, you know, Waller stays the way he's going, that should be a good construction. In that case, did you feel the need to kind of like hammer a wide receiver from that point?
I did, but only to a certain extent. I guess I had some confidence that in how I'd be able to build out from there. And you know, certain rounds, there were receiver runs. Again, when you're picking on the end, especially of a deeper league, like a 14 teamer, yeah, things can really go haywire. So I was concerned with certain things, and, you know, certain guys that I was targeting and hoping for didn't pan out the way that I was hoping. So I didn't hammer receiver the way that I was kind of expecting to, but I still think that it turned out okay. I was able to target some guys in the later rounds that made some sense. So after I went with Kupp, I got Jamar Chase at the end of the fifth, and I felt good about that one. Will Fuller had gone just before. I was hoping to get Chase and Jerry Jeudy, but Jerry Jeudy went right after Jamar Chase. So that was unfortunate, but it just kind of spurned me to go ahead and get my first quarterback, which ended up being Justin Herbert there in the sixth.
Yeah, I like Herbert, definitely. He's going pretty late, and I can't really figure out why. I guess people are just kind of thinking that the touchdown rate's going to come down, which is reasonable enough, but he's the real deal and gives you that dual threat upside too. So I think if Cooper Kupp stays healthy, that's a pretty sound loadout in my opinion, even if a lot of people would say like, oh, you got to do better at receiver than that. I think some of the truth is with, you know, people like us who are plugged into this stuff way too much and know as much about the prospects as we do. Like, we feel like we can kind of get those sleeper wide receivers better than the more casual wagerer who's maybe playing like four different sports at the same time. It's like, because we're deep in the, you know, the grinding minds, the tape grinding minds.
That's right.
You know, all hours of all seasons of the year, we know we can get that Bryan Edwards, and we don't care about Cooper Kupp being our wide receiver one.
See, exactly. So that a bit of hubris there, and you know, I'll give a quick spoiler. The guy that I finished out my draft with, or second to last pick, my last skill position guy was Elijah Moore. So, you know, if he ends up starting for me, I'd feel good about playing out this league. I think that there's a very real chance that he has an awesome rookie season. I mean, just the talent alone, and I think that the role is going to be right there for him. I guess we still need to get the...
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this. But Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Jameson Crowder conundrum,
yeah.
Shit sorted out, but I imagine it will, you know, to quote Office Space, take care of itself. Yeah.
Especially after the Keelan Cole signing, they got to get rid of him. But yeah, I think Elijah Moore is basically what people wanted and thought Deontay Johnson was. It's like he's got the speed to take that whole profile to an actual, you know, 100 and a productive 150 targets, not like 150 useless targets in a bad offense.
See, exactly. So that will be great to see. I look forward to that. Before we get on to our next group of picks, we got a quick message from our sponsors. And then up next, after I went with Justin Herbert, maybe in hindsight, I wish I got a little bit more receivers between now and Elijah Moore, but some other guys that I targeted a little bit later on, I got Zach Moss. He's one of the guys that I'm definitely going to be trying to target. You know, when you get to pick 100 or so, I think that's kind of the way to go. I think that, you know, that's a Buffalo offense that wasn't particularly run heavy, especially with its running backs, because Josh Allen is able to pick up, you know, so much of that on his own. But, you know, I think the question will be settled as to whether Moss is the best option in that backfield. And obviously with the way that the draft went, you know, Buffalo was a concern for the Moss investors, because, you know, what if they went with Javonte Williams at the end of the first round, something like, you know, at that point you'd start to be concerned about the workload split. But I'm confident that Moss is better than Devin Singletary. So I think he'll, you know, this year, not his rookie year anymore. We're going to see the growing pains, you know, not really in the picture anymore. And I know you're a Zach Moss guy too. So what are your thoughts on him as a running back in that kind of tier towards the back end of, you know, the eighth round in regular 12 teamers?
Yeah, I think Moss is one of those guys you at the very least have to keep in mind if you're doing a zero running back construction. And it's, I guess in his case, it's a little weirder. It's a little bit different of a speculation scenario than with other running back targets for zero running back approaches, because normally you're speculating on a running back and zero running back, hoping that the starter ahead of him gets hurt, or the guy that he's splitting snaps with, whatever, gets hurt. With Zach Moss, you're kind of wagering on Josh Allen getting hurt, because I don't really think they're going to change the offensive design too much. And the way the offense was built last year, there just isn't that much carry-wise to go around for the running backs. There could be some pass-catching work, and Zach Moss can definitely do that. I think we can say Devin Singletary probably cannot. So that's a big detail to keep in mind. I saw there's still some Devin Singletary truthers out there, and I understand liking the guy as a player. I mean, he's underdog who, you know, plays with a ton of motor, and he's much stronger than or he packs more of a wallop than someone as small as him should, and you know that's kind of cool aesthetically to watch, and it's easy player to root for. But he just doesn't have the pass catching skill set, and he's not fast. He's not actually physically strong. He just kind of gets anchor leverage on some guys and has a lot of motor to get him through the chain sometimes. And that's great for a backup, but it's not somebody that you want to be starting too much in your offense. So Zach Moss has injury concerns. He got nicked up a bit at Utah, especially with his knee. I can't remember what it was last year, but obviously he got hurt last year too. But he seemed to me kind of ahead of Devin Singletary, even in week one and week two, at least in the sense that he was the goal line and the passing down guy. And I think those are by far, you know, more important than whatever's in between that Singletary's getting. So with all that said, if Josh Allen does get hurt, then that offense has to totally change its look. You can't run those things, the four wides, all those deep attacking pass formations. You can't do that with just anybody. So if Allen gets hurt, I think they're going to kind of roll back the offense a little bit and put more of the workload on the running backs, which they can't really do out of their general alignments. I think I know there were rumors about the Bills looking at drafting a running back, but I kind of just don't believe they were real, because Singletary and Moss were both third rounders, and there's something like 18 carries per game to go between the two of them. It would have been insane to spend a first rounder on a running back.
That's a good framing there. And you know, if their offense was explosive as it was a year ago, then you know, why try to tinker it in a way that takes away from, you know, the kind of inherent advantages that having a Josh Allen back there and having Stephon Diggs out there, and of course now they have Emmanuel Sanders. Going to the Ravens offense wouldn't make sense. They'll probably keep it fairly in the air and keep things relatively the same. Some other guys that I went with. I know this is just a one quarterback league, but I wanted to get Trevor Lawrence. I could sense one of my fellow drafters was, I think, working on a Jaguar stack. So I kind of did that to block him a little bit. And also just kind of as an endorsement that it's okay to take a couple of quarterbacks relatively early. I mean, maybe I'm not doing this if I had taken Patrick Mahomes, but you know, adding a little bit of volume between like QB6 and QB12, getting two of those top 12 guys, I think it makes plenty of sense, even in a one quarterback, because you don't want to be, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel for the waiver wire and you know, doing the equivalent of having to start Andy Dalton from last season. So felt good about grabbing Lawrence. I grabbed Chuba Hubbard. Hunter Henry was my second tight end that I got. And I do want to hear your thoughts on Henry, actually, and you know, which of those two new England tight ends you would be targeting at current ADP.
So for the price, I prefer Jonnu Smith, but that's only because it generally seems like Jonnu goes later than Henry, sometimes by as much as like a couple rounds, which I understand what the concerns are as stated, but I don't really understand how. Personally, I can't really agree with the reasoning that makes such a distinction between the two. If anything, I would probably put Jonnu ahead of Hunter Henry, just because, like, this is definitely reading between the lines a lot and taking some liberties, some assumptions. But if the Patriots are trying to build something even loosely resembling what they did with this type of tight end personnel in the past with Rob Gronkowski and Aaron Hernandez, then Jonnu Smith is the one who plays the Aaron Hernandez role, if anyone is going to play it. And that's the one with a lot less blocking. Now, you can have a Gronkowski, obviously, who puts up, you know, 1,200 yards and 14 touchdowns or whatever, even when he's playing that more blocking intensive role. But that's why Rob Gronkowski is maybe the best tight end ever, because normally when you do the stuff that he does, you don't catch passes the way he did. It's just not as easy. You're not running as many routes, and the routes that you run, you're getting chipped like two or three times before you're five steps into your route, and Gronk could handle it. He was, you know, he's this juggernaut guy who can break through those kinds of conditions and still make a lot of plays, especially in the red zone. But Hunter Henry is not Rob Gronkowski. Hunter Henry might be a very good tight end, and he could maybe even be a big fantasy factor going through those exact same conditions, even if he has the Gronk role rather than you know, the move tight end type functions. But for me, it's a question with Henry. Whereas with Jonnu, there's no question he can do that stuff for sure. He should be used in that role. Jonnu is a very good blocker. It's kind of funny. You watch Derrick Henry highlights and you see Jonnu throwing around these guys who are so much bigger than him. But he is a pass catcher. He's very good at pass catching. He's very athletic. At Florida International, he had one of the best pass catching seasons for any tight end in college football history as like a 19-year-old sophomore. So he does not need to be a blocker. He can catch, I think, 90 passes if they throw him the ball that many times. Now, they probably won't, but the skill set and the traits are all there. So I like Jonnu because I just think that if someone's going to get stuck with the inline role, I think it would be Henry. And also, I guess Henry does have a little bit of a durability history. I don't know. Whether,
definitely.
Maybe it's irresponsible to try to factor that in any way, but he's definitely gotten nicked up quite a bit. And if he is the inline guy, he'll have the role that's more like physically demanding of the two.
Yeah, no, I think he would. And you know, that puts a bit of a magnifying glass then on the durability concerns, because like you said, Hunter Henry has had plenty of them throughout his tenure with the Chargers. Let's table my draft for now. You know, we don't need to get into which kicker I took or I did take the Buccaneers defense as the first defense off the board, because again, I wanted to cut off the chance of ending up getting like the 10th best defense, that sort of thing. So I just went ahead and kind of started that, and then the run came back the following round. But let's talk a little bit more just about these running back tiers and kind of how you want to navigate the early rounds of your drafts, the first three rounds specifically, because you know that's where you got to get your alpha running back, the guy that's, you know, even if you are going with a pass catcher heavy approach, I think you still kind of need one of these guys. It's almost like, you know, to use a baseball or fantasy baseball analogy, you know, like skewing aces entirely, you know, that can definitely get you burned. So I mean, these are rare commodities, the running backs, the true workhorses. So I want to work through how you're approaching them. McCaffrey, I think is kind of like obviously the number one guy, and I think Dalvin Cook also is kind of solidified as the number two, but I think running backs 3 through 5, especially in PPR, are kind of up for debate. So I wanted to get your thoughts on Kamara, on Saquon Barkley, and Jonathan Taylor. I think that in PPR, Derrick Henry kind of falls closer to the sixth or the seventh guy. But I wanted to start things out specifically asking you, when it comes to Kamara, we know he's an amazing talent. We do. But so much of his production these last couple of years, you know, thanks to Drew Brees being there and not being able to throw the ball 10 yards downfield, is that Kamara was just like an automatic part of that offense. Do you think that continues to the same extent now that they're going to be going with either Jameis Winston or Taysom Hill? I would feel better about Kamara maybe if it was Taysom Hill, but also maybe not. I know we had a couple games of sample of that last season as well. So just your thoughts on Kamara and his ability to kind of keep up the production sans Drew Brees.
Well, I can imagine a certain offensive design where Taysom Hill would be fine or even good for Alvin Kamara. I don't think they ran an offense like that last year when Taysom Hill played last year, though. I think instead of, like, basically you would have to remove all usage except Kamara and Michael Thomas, and you'd have to go very up-tempo to offset the fact that you're running so much more than you used to or than you would with an alternative quarterback. So he's bad for the number of plays logged in any given game, and he is bad for Alvin Kamara's like per target efficiency and volume, obviously. So those are pretty big concerns for a guy who so much of his theoretical value is as a pass catcher. In PPR, scoring especially is where he's good. He loses a little bit, I think, in standard scoring, because we don't really expect Kamara to run for like 1,100 yards or anything like that. We need him to get to something like 500, 600 as a pass catcher to be the guy that we have in mind when we draft him. So for me, Jameis Winston would be preferable because he's going to turn more higher share of the offense to pass attempts than under Taysom Hill, and they're going to run more plays than they would under Taysom Hill. It would be probably good for Alvin Kamara's efficiency as a runner if Taysom Hill is on the field, just because the bootleg threat with Hill makes it hard for you to load up in the interior gaps to try to sit on the run. You can do it, but it's risky, so you kind of just tend to concede more space in the interior of the defense. But if Taysom Hill's stealing a lot of those extra run plays, then that's bad. And then the clock's running more. So I think the efficiency gain as a runner is not as much as the harm done to him as a pass catcher. So I hope Jameis Winston is the starter. I think he will be. And I think that if he is, then Kamara should be fine, at least in PPR. Like, I'm not expecting a 14 rushing touchdown season from Kamara, but I think Winston, despite all of his goofiness, is conducive enough to fantasy production that he would be fine for Kamara. And in some ways, there might be like new possibilities there because regardless of Sean Payton's play calling, Winston on the field instead of Breeze means the safeties have to play differently. And we've never really seen a Saints offense where Kamara can, you know, catch the ball and then have 10 yards of space before the next guy's on him. It's like he's always had to make a lot of insane moves. And Winston, if he can get a vertical element going, Kamara could, A, get in on that a little bit, and B, if he's catching short passes, maybe there's a little more room to run. So I'm pretty optimistic about Kamara actually in PPR if Winston's the starter. But if it is Hill, then yeah, he's – like, Henry's going too high, I should say. Like, in PPR, I love Henry. He should not be going fourth. He should not be going ahead of Barkley. Maybe Barkley if you're worried about the knee, but he shouldn't be going ahead of Taylor. He shouldn't be going ahead of Ezekiel Elliott. So I think Kamara might be in that Derrick Henry tier for me, though, if Taysom Hill somehow ends up starting.
Okay. All right. That's a good distinction. So obviously that'll be a training camp battle that everyone is paying extremely close attention to. But as it stands, all right. So given the condition that Winston is starting week one, you feel comfortable with Kamara at three then in PPR drafts?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's even a case to if you're doing a lot of volume and you get a lot of second picks, I don't think there's anything wrong with getting Kamara exposure there instead of Cook, just because Cook has, you know, this, he's got the shoulder injury history, which is pretty uniquely bad, pretty uniquely high risk among this tier of running backs. But obviously, if Cook doesn't get hurt, he's just insane every single game, pretty much.
Okay. All right. That definitely checks out. Let's get into then Jonathan Taylor versus Saquon Barkley, because I think that's one where people aren't thinking enough and they're just assuming that Saquon Barkley, you know, a guy that went in the top 10 or went second overall a couple years ago and has those highlight plays. Oh, he'll definitely be, he's definitely worth the number four pick over Jonathan Taylor 10 times out of 10. And I like, on a talent basis, Saquon Barkley, at least pre-injury, as far as we know, probably a better back than Jonathan Taylor, but on just talent alone, but play, you know, not a slam dunk necessarily. And then Jonathan Taylor, though, I mean, he's a guy who really broke out down the stretch last year, had an amazing college career, as we know, as Madison guys. But he also has a better team context. And it pains me to say that for a Carson Wentz led team. But I mean, even with Anthony Costanzo being retired, I just think that Indianapolis offensive line is a much better, more conducive climate for good rushing production. Jonathan Taylor also proved that he can be good as a pass catcher last year as well. Whereas Barkley, man, I mean, it looks like Andrew Thomas was a complete whiff as a top 10 pick last year. I think they got rid of Kevin Zeitler this past offseason, if I remember correctly. So, you know, there's some questions on that Giants offensive line to where, you know, that combined with Saquon Barkley coming off the ACL tear, I go Taylor.
Yeah, that's fair. For me, that's one of those where I have to look at it as kind of just an exposure question. Like, I feel like they both have like first overall upside. And I think because of his knee, I would call Barkley's downside a little bit lower than Taylor's. But it's really hard to know. I mean, we can't know the things that will cause them to go whichever way they do as the season unfolds. So at some point, if you're doing a certain amount of volume, I feel like you kind of just got to concede that's sometimes chance will just negate whatever otherwise correct reasoning you might be operating on and just kind of protect yourself a little bit by hedging at least. But I think I would probably put Taylor ahead of Barkley in most of my rankings, just because I actually think I probably prefer Taylor as a player. Like, I know Barkley is a really insane athlete, and as a pass catcher, he's great, but I really do think he has trouble seeing the field out of the backfield. I don't think he's really a natural running back in terms of reading blocks and anticipating space. I feel like he's more of a guy who kind of runs with horse blinders on. And it's like, if you let him see daylight, you can't catch him. But if you just kind of stay around him and contain him, he's not going to really just break out. He's not going to ever pull a Houdini on anybody. Whereas with Taylor, I think the vision is there more so than with Barkley. And Barkley's a great athlete, but I guess Barkley might have been a little bit heavier, but Taylor's actually faster in the 40, isn't he? He was like a 4.39, and I feel like I can't remember what Barkley. But anyway, to me, Taylor is a total blue chip. I realize I'm higher on him as a prospect than most people, but to me, Taylor is pretty close to like a perfect running back prospect. I wouldn't even consider Dalvin Cook. I think is the only player, and Nick Chubb, I think, are the only two players with as much natural pure running ability as Jonathan Taylor. So for him to have no knee concerns and Barkley having both the knee and kind of like the offensive line concerns, I guess it could be a pretty tough defensive division. I don't know. I lean Taylor, but I guess I just have to probably concede that I'm a little bit biased, I guess.
Okay. And I think, you know, the exposure detail makes sense if you're doing a whole bunch of drafts, but you know, again, if you're just doing the one home league type of thing, you get that spot. I think Taylor would be the move.
I actually think there's a really good case to take Zeke over both of them, but
let's hear it. I do want to hear that because like he's someone that I've kind of just banished from my thought process, honestly, after how last year went.
Yeah, last year was pretty brutal optics wise. I mean, it was legitimately embarrassing after he had fumbled like seven times or whatever it was. But it was also to me one of those things where it was pretty clearly like everything just went wrong. And after a certain point, it stopped having any meaning. It's like, yeah, it's like an entire house is on fire. And like each time another floor goes down, you're like, wow. It's like, man, the whole look at it. It's toast. Who cares? Like,
yeah.
It's not getting worse every time some other thing falls over. It's scrapped. So maybe not. Maybe he actually declined and those were indications of decline. But I feel like too many other things were going wrong for that to be the most likely explanation. And if the conditions are more to what he's used to and he doesn't have the yips, like that was Ezekiel Elliott probably like never had a thing go wrong in his whole football career, like on the field, obviously. Nothing ever went wrong in his whole career until that moment. Like Ohio State, even in his early NFL years, it was all he ever knew was just complete success. And experiencing that kind of embarrassment for the first time might have gotten to his head a little bit. But with Dak Prescott on the field, assuming he is and assuming he's who he was before the injury, that offense is going to go places regardless of Elliott's involvement. And incidentally, he will probably be very involved.
Yes, I think he will too, and yeah, I think you can give some forgiveness for the way things went last year, especially after the Dak Prescott injury. I mean that changed everything, and I mean some of the pass catchers were still able to have some production, but you know Zeke obviously, I mean like a full like half yard basically worse than we've known him to be on a per carry basis throughout this point of his career. Like you said, the fumbles were bad. He was dropping passes. Just a kind of a strange season. But is the Dak detail alone good, like enough to make you buy back into this extent on Zeke? I mean, especially given that the offensive line is not nearly what it was. You know, 2016, you couldn't have a Ezekiel Elliott conversation without talking about how good that offensive line was.
That's true. It's something to think about. But I guess given the alternatives, the particular alternatives that they are, it's like you got Barkley with the knee and the offensive line of a similar level of concern. Quarterback, it's like even the good case scenarios for Daniel Jones don't get particularly close to the middle range outcomes for Prescott, in my opinion. And with Taylor, man, I know that Colts offensive line has been really good, but Sam Tevy might be one of those guys who's so bad that he just collapses the whole unit. I guess it didn't quite happen with the Chargers last year, but that might have had something to do with Herbert, because you're, as a defense, approaching a pass rush very differently against Herbert than you are Carson Wentz. With Wentz, you are not intimidated.
And Wentz can create his own sacks better than any other quarterback in the league.
Yeah, so I'm actually a little bit worried about the Colts just not being very good on offense. I think because of the workload projection and the talent detail with Taylor, you don't let that scare you off the pick, but it's the kind of thing that would keep me from moving him into the top three or something like that. And I think with Elliott, you get at least as much of a share of the offense as Taylor. probably as much as with Barkley too. And the quarterback is just non-negotiably so much better than those guys have. So he's like Elliott, you would have to project to have significantly better like field position per touch and like, you know, scoring opportunities, things like that, average drive length, average points per drive, stuff like that.
Okay. All right. That definitely checks out as well. Another kind of, or moving on to another tier. This is a guy who, well, I want to talk about Aaron Jones and I want to talk about J.K. Dobbins. And when it comes to Dobbins, first off, it feels like I could believe at pretty much anywhere after pick 9 or 10, depending on who had been taken before, that sure, he's a fine pick, or I could see him falling to 20 or late second round and being like, yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense too. He's kind of a value there, that type of thing. But where are you with him specifically? And then, you know, how does that compare to where you're at with Aaron Jones?
Well, Aaron Jones, I think you got to put quite a bit higher, at least in PPR, just because he doesn't even really play a pure running back position for the Packers. It's almost like some kind of flanker hybrid, almost a little bit like Kamara and the Saints. So because of that structural detail and definitely the touchdown sort of upside that he has, I'm probably keeping Jones a level above. Admittedly, the Rodgers drama is pretty concerning. That'll do a hell of a lot of damage to Aaron Jones's touchdown projection if Rodgers isn't there. So I guess we'll see. But for me, Dobbins has just a little bit of a limitation for the pass catching upside, I guess. Like, obviously he's the pass catcher between himself and Gus Edwards. Gus Edwards isn't a threat to encroach upon that. But no. The pass catching running back role for the Ravens has about as much pass catching use as like a lot of teams' backup running back positions. So it's hard for him to keep up with some of the other guys in this top range there, which puts a lot of pressure on his running production, which he may or may not, you know, reach to return value, like especially if he has touchdown production like last year. He had a lot of touchdowns for a guy with as few carries as he had. That's at once begging for regression, but also something you can look at with him and his fit in that offense and the offense as it is and say, well, yeah, you would project him to have higher than usual touchdown production because Lamar Jackson gets you into scoring range a lot and Dobbins is really good. People have definitely lost sight of how good Dobbins is. Like I saw somebody from another site posting rankings yesterday where like Dobbins was like 6 spots behind a Najee Harris or something in the running backs of the last 2 years. And I guess for this year, I can understand taking Najee Harris ahead of him, but Dobbins is really, really good. He's in my opinion, he's better than Cam Akers as a talent. Obviously Akers has this better team fit right now, but it seems like people are kind of thinking Dobbins is just sort of like the best running back the Ravens have lying around or somebody who's pretty good or something like that. And Dobbins is an all pro talent if he gets the right usage. Like there's a sort of lack of just clarity on who these players are in a lot of cases. And I think Dobbins is a guy who suffers from that a little bit, but I probably wouldn't end up with too many shares at the current ADP just because I prefer Clyde Edwards-Helaire, at least in PPR scoring, and he tends to go a little bit later. And I can't really take Dobbins over like Joe Mixon or Antonio Gibson. So I'm probably not getting Dobbins shares right now, but if the price goes up on Edwards-Helaire or if, I don't know, if Dobbins like slips to Miles Sanders range, I guess, like then I'll probably start buying because the talent is not a question to me. I mean, people, whatever people think about Dobbins, they have to understand that the gripes with him, the limitations with him are structural. The talent is definitely among the best. Like he's really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mark Ingram, the previous year, his good year in Baltimore, he averaged 5 yards a carry. J.K. Dobbins, less carries last year than Ingram had in 2019, of course, but, you know, for still a statistically significant amount. Dobbins averaged 6 yards a carry. And, you know, this is, you know, with Ronnie Stanley being out for basically the entire time that Dobbins had broken out, he didn't really get, he had really frustrating usage the first half of the season all the way through the bye week before he started really getting the workload and started making Mark Ingram a healthy scratch. So I think, yeah, the sky's the limit as far as he's not going to keep up 6 yards per carry over 220 carries. But I think that, you know, he could be a guy that's, you know, pushing 5 yards a carry. So then again, I understand the problem with the pass catching volume. So maybe he's more of a target in standard scoring. I mean, even again, using the Mark Ingram example from 2019, Ingram had like 30 catches maybe only 30 targets. So yeah, that again, what wasn't a particularly big function of the Ravens offense. And you don't think it's going to be again, like when the Ravens throw, they throw it down the field. They don't really check it down to the running back so much. So that definitely limits the ceiling when it comes to Dobbins. But yeah, as far as pure rushing production goes this year, it should be really, really strong. So I don't know, like, again, where Jeff took him, Jeff Erickson took him in this draft, I think 9th or 10th overall. You probably won't have to go that high to get him. Right. But you know, if he's around in the, you know, mid to late second, I think you should consider him.
It looks like sometimes he falls even into like the very early third. So yeah, if I had an opportunity to take him there, that's not so hard. That's one of those where it's like, oh, okay, I'm not so worried at that price.
Okay, exactly. And then I guess I'll leave you with one more toss up. These two guys went back to back, Antonio Gibson and Joe Mixon. How do you sort that one out? Do you think that where they went in this draft kind of makes sense as like kind of early second round guys, that type of thing?
Sorry, I lost the screen. Which order did they go in this draft?
It went Gibson first, Mixon right after.
Yeah, I prefer Gibson, and I guess part of that is I'm getting a little bit losing the faith with Mixon talent-wise. Like, I think he's good, and I think he's better than a lot of his numbers with the Bengals have indicated, but with the injuries kind of piling up with him and the actual breakthrough still not really happening on a consistent basis, it's getting a little harder to keep that faith. I'm a little concerned that he's less the kind of standout dominant talent that he looked like coming out of Oklahoma and more like a baseline runner who looks good when the offense is good, but if the offense is bad, kind of sinks with it. So it's a little bit more risk there in my mind than with Gibson, who already has shown better baseline fantasy production than Mixon has, I feel like, in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Because when Gibson was actually getting work last year, he was, granted, he did play the Cowboys twice and had like 9 touchdowns against them. But
good weeks.
He was really good last year, and he was in his second year playing running back. And tools wise, he's better than Mixon. I think you can't really call the Bengals offensive line better than the Washington one, even though they both kind of suck. But the fact that the Washington offensive line sucked and the quarterbacks were so bad still didn't really matter much for Gibson last year. And I think that Gibson has a ton of untapped pass catching upside, and Mixon does too. But with Gibson, it's like he can be peak David Johnson. Whereas with Mixon, you're hoping that he's, you know, just the guy you've been waiting on for 3 years now that still hasn't happened.
Okay. All right. So that definitely settles that. And I tend to side with you on that. And yeah, when it comes to Joe Mixon, I'm
pretty much out. Okay. Like a little bit. It's just the kind of thing, like if he does stay healthy and he is good, he's going to catch more passes with Gio Bernard gone. Like I like Samaje Perine a little bit, but he's not going to be taking up as much pass catching role as Gio did. So they're going to try to make Mixon happen. The question is just like, is he good enough? And I think he kind of is, but I'm not as sold as a couple other guys going in the similar range.
Okay. All right. That checks out. And, For the listeners out there still paying attention to the Roto Staff dynasty, Chris Evans guy here.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think P. Ryan's got him, but I don't know. Travion Williams. Also, guys get hurt. Like teams are just that could be a practice squad pick. It might not be. Who knows? But I like Samaje as the handcuff just because I don't know. I'm still a little bit of a truther, I guess. I respect that. He's been better than some of these other guys who have gotten more run than him. I think he did enough last year. He deserves another shot.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I think that's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast, brought to you by our friends over at WinBet. For Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening.
Try RotoWire today, free for 10 days. Get our premium tools, rankings, analysis, and breaking news alerts. No credit card required. Go to rotowire.com/try.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.